Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Today we'll talk about some of the top issues in the news you care about the most. And I'm joined by activist Mary Washington and journalist Bob Summerby to discuss the 2008 presidential election, immigration, oil prices, or anything else you'd like to discuss. So give us a call at 410-319-8888 and join the conversation. Then we'll learn about a historic tennis match that occurred in Druid Hill Park on July 11th, 1948. On that day, black, white, and Jewish tennis players integrated the clay courts, the white-only clay tennis courts in the park. Over two dozen people were arrested. We'll talk with two women who were there, including one who played in that historic game. So join me today on The Mark Steiner Show, right after this NPR news break. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this morning. And join us here at 410-319-8888. In the first part of our program this morning, we're going to tackle a little national, local issues. Two, and specifically, we're going to talk about this presidential campaign and why we're talking so much about Mr. Obama moving to the center. And as he says, maybe I'm not moving to the center, maybe I just don't agree with you. I just love the way he comes back sometimes. We will look at some news that nobody's heard about yet from city schools and what's happening to teachers. It hasn't hit the press, and we'll talk about that a little bit more with our two guests and you. We have in the studio with us Dr. Mary Washington, who's a community activist, ran a very hard-fought campaign in 2006 to become a delegate in the 43rd and almost unseated those long-entrenched incumbents, and she may try again. She's with us in the studio, and Bob Summerby is with us, a longtime journalist, a former school teacher, editor of the Daily Howler, and former op-ed writer for the Baltimore Sun when he wrote pieces way back when for about education and many other things. And welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Well, it's great good to be here.
Great to be here.
And join us here, 410-319-8888. Is Mr. McCain telling the truth? Is Mr. Obama flopping around? Or is this just stuff we should not be talking about and just giving over our presidential campaign to the pundits?
One of the exciting things I found about and actually made me very proud about the Obama campaign and Obama as a candidate is that he's very thoughtful. So any person that has a position or is trying to figure out our hugely challenging issues that are facing this country and you're going to take different points of view, you're going to hopefully be informed and have your position and your policies affected by new information. So it might be that our political pundits are not accustomed to people taking actual data and information and making informed decisions. And so they kind of construct that as flip-flopping. I don't see it as flip-flopping. I think from the very beginning, we were very excited about the speech about we're not a red state country or a blue states country. We're purple in so many ways. And I think that becoming accustomed to that there is not just a black and white, and clearly if anyone represents that in their very person is Barack Obama. So I think it's a lot of nothing, and I think the public and folks will see that in the short run.
Hey, it's probably a lot of nothing. It's hard to tell. I mean, the serious topic here is he moving to the center, quote unquote, regarding Iraq. I think it's a little hard to gather that from the little tiny phraseology that was seized upon at the end of last week. I mean, it's just, he may be trying to inch his way in some manner or other away from his previous position. That's possible, but you certainly can't tell from that one little tiny bit of phraseology. But this is a narrative that the pundit corps loves, moving to the center. It's something they've memorized. They've heard about this. They say it. I'm serious. They've committed it to memory. They just hugely praised candidate Bush 8 years ago for moving to the center in the spring of 2000. There's a tremendous amount of work on that on my website. I mean, this was the brilliant move, moving to the center, blah, blah, blah. This is something they talk about every 4 years. It's silly in this case. Probably. It would be nice if, I mean, I think Obama has made very clear he has not changed his position on Iraq, according to him. Now, what will he do a year from now if he's president? Well, we don't exactly know. But a lot of this is silly, deeply silly. you know, this is a world with a, this is a nation with a list of issues as long as all our arms that are very, very serious issues, and we just can't seem to get them discussed. You know, we like to talk about who got their feelings hurt yesterday, what did General Clark say that made someone mad, what did someone say on the other side. I mean, it's just silly pseudo-disputes. And I would say this thing about Iraq, well, it's very important to know. I would say it's not at all clear that he's moving to the center. There's no way of knowing.
Well, Mark, too, my question is kind of a, what is the center in the United States? I mean, do we actually have a left? Do we actually have a right? I mean, what does the center look like? And again, you sort of use this term, mm-hmm. this concept, this political concept, even liberal. What is liberal? You know, what is progressive? We don't have nuanced discussions. You're exactly right. We have a traditional press corps that has a narrative that knows the story prior to writing the story, and they just pick information, pick facts to fit the story. And depending on
it. Well, I wonder what it is. I'm curious to see what you all think it is at 410-319-8888. What is it about the way we cover this presidential election? What are the things that you think about? Why is it that we talk about horse races, who's going to be a vice president, speculation on that, and are you moving to the center rather than talking about the issues? Are you bored with the issues? Do people care about the issues? Or is the press just making up its mind not to cover the issues and just cover kind of a glamorous horse race? We're sitting with Dr. Mary Washington and Bob Somerby. What do you think? You can see what Bob thinks at thedailyholler.com, and you can hear what Dr. Mary Washington thinks right here, 410-319-8888, as we look at this before we talk about some local issues. So, I mean, what is it about? Why is it so difficult to get these discussions on the air? Are they just not sexy enough? Do they not grab people? Are they unimportant for most Americans?
You know,
is it the media falling down on its job?
It's hard. You know, my website is about the media.
Yes.
And you hate to generalize, because there are people in the press corps who are very serious and do good work. That's not the predominant strain in the mainstream media. For the most part, I would say if you look at the top end of the mainstream media, this is a millionaire-driven cohort that doesn't care about serious issues. They clearly don't care. Now, who's the most famous columnist in America? Maureen Dowd has been having a sort of an identity crisis at the New York Times for the last several weeks. Her columns, including her column today, just defiantly fatuous. You couldn't get these people to talk about serious things if their lives were at stake. They simply don't care. And I've argued for years, if you have a millionaire press corps, inevitably this is the kind... A millionaire-driven press corps, which is what we have, where the opinion leaders are all multimillionaires. This is the kind of pseudo-discussion, pseudo-silly, personality-driven discussion you're inevitably going to get. You couldn't make these people discuss issues if their lives were at stake. They aren't going to do it. They won't do it. They don't want to do it. And it bores them. And that's, I would say, while there are many people in the press corps who would like to do good work and some who do good work, I would say that's the overall culture of the press corps at this point.
And if you forgive my sort of blatant sociology or my Marxist analysis, we do have to remember the ownership of the production, right? I mean, who mm-hmm. owns the press? Mm-hmm. Who owns the newspapers? Increasingly, who are paying for the pop-ups that are coming when you're doing online? I mean, we cannot forget that that the press are workers. And to a certain extent, you need to, while we say we have a free press, we've noted, even in our own city, great media pundits or great media writers that have been let go of some of the top places. So, you know, we have to remember that to a certain extent, you have to please your bosses. And to the extent that the bosses are not interested in these stories, I think is very evident.
I'm told that General Electric owns NBC News, although I refuse to believe it.
410-319-8888. The presidential election in this part of the Mark Steiner Show early, before we move on to another topic. Your thoughts about the lack of coverage, the kind of coverage we have, and at 410-319-8888, let us go to Mike in Ellicott City. You are on the air.
Good afternoon, folks.
Morning.
Good morning. That's better. I hope the rest of my comments will be more accurate. but I'll tell you, nothing important is going to change when it gets to be afternoon. But here's what's going to happen in the elections. You guys are aware There's a presidential election coming up, and I have some predictions that are a reflection of the campaigns that we're being subjected to. First of all, and I especially hope the Marxists will take note on this, because I'm a Marxist myself, either Barack Obama or John McCain is going to become the next U.S. president. You got that right. Second, there will be more homeless. Third, there will be troops in Iraq. Fourth, the polarization between wealth and poverty will continue to exacerbate. Conclusion, we've got to figure out what the hell we're going to do. We, you know, the people who are subjected to this, so that we could get control of our country. I don't know what to do, but I think people got to start talking seriously about it.
Mike, thanks for your call. You know, I think that when we talk about Barack Obama's positions, people being upset about saying he's going to keep troops in Iraq just as long as McCain might, and that those issues there, though he clearly was against the war from the beginning. They didn't do much to fight against the war while he was in the Senate, though he was against the war from the beginning. I mean, we can expect. I mean, what can you expect? I mean, both these candidates, McCain and Obama, re-represent the interests of people with a lot of wealth in America on one level, but they are different spectrums. One's more liberal and progressive. One's more conservative. But in a sense, in Iraq, I think they both want to protect the interests of America in Iraq, and so we shouldn't be so shocked about that. I think.
You can never know what someone's going to do a year from now. Yeah, there's no way of knowing, you know, what either one of these people would do a year from now or, you know, whenever. And only through a more detailed discussion do people get put on the record as far as what they claim they would do and what might they do. And that discussion sort of hasn't been happening. Now, you know, there's been no forums lately in which candidates would be asked questions about these matters. But when they are asked questions, they're asked questions about little two-word phrases that they used in extemporaneous speech. And that's just a ludicrous way to start getting people on the record about what they would do. Of course, there's no way to know what either one of them will do in some circumstance a year from now.
Well, the big thing about McCain this morning was that he made some comment about, since they found out that the biggest export to Iran from America was cigarettes, he apparently made
a joke.
He made a joke about, that's maybe this one way to kill off the Iranians or whatever, something similar to that. And, you know, but...
Now we'll have an angry discussion about that for 3 days. I mean, especially on cable.
Right.
Less so in newspapers. But our cable discussion is built around pseudo-outrage over jokes or phraseology. And it goes on for days at a time until the next pseudo-discussion can start.
Well, in part, Mark, I think, too, is that we have to remember that there's realistically, there's a small proportion, I think, of the voting population that's actually paying attention to any of this right now.
I think that's right.
And one of the things that I would like to not see is that the excitement, the enthusiasm that was built up around the Democratic primary be ground into dust because of this just inch by inch, day by day reporting of the campaign to the extent that it becomes boring and uninteresting, and that people turn off. And I think a lot of people are, in fact, turning off now because they don't want to hear the candidates get into this kind of personal. Not just the candidates, but actually the campaigns getting into this kind of personal he said, back and forth. And that I think where the public will reinsert itself again, will be in September and in October. But right now, I think a lot of people are focusing on getting their kids to school, on summer camp, on joblessness, on concerns about the environment. And as you said earlier, that there are tons of issues that are actually affecting everyday Baltimoreans and Marylanders that are simply not of interest and are not being covered on CNN or C-SPAN.
Yeah, the front page of the paper today concerns climate change, the G8 statements on climate change, which, you know, let's face it, this is presented, if we believe the science, as a history-changing situation we're confronting. So what do the candidates have to say about that? There's, you know, go ahead, look for the discussion. It's just not being...
It's not taking place.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, and I'm not saying this to blame the candidates.
No.
I'm saying it's not taking place within the mainstream press corps.
And one of the things I'd like to talk about here, I think at some point maybe on the show later, is this whole argument around that this carbon credits they're talking about in the G8, and also what they're doing in Maryland here. Chesapeake Bay Foundation has suggested something very similar for industries to be able to have credits for their pollution, to offset their pollution if they put certain money into a fund. And there's this whole other argument, people are having, are carbon credits just a mockery of the real issue? They really do nothing. They just create a environment neutral solution that does nothing to protect the environment, but makes industry feel good and makes people think that something is changing when it's not.
Well, you have carbon credits, and then you have offset fees that actually can be put into a fund that communities can apply for to use to do restoration.
But those industries are still polluting.
They are, again.
So, I mean,
but,
you know,
sometimes it's about mitigating what is actually happening. Sometimes you can't stop it, but sometimes you can try to correct what you've done. So the extent that we can kind of slow down change the laws, change permitting in Baltimore City to require certain levels of green infrastructure to be built in the city, and then to penalize those who are saying, hey, I still want to do what I'm going to do, and then allow communities to access these funds, whether it's to create more green jobs in communities, to provide more opportunities for children to play, and to create playgrounds, to create youth opportunities for job training and natural resources. I mean, these are all, so I totally get the part about the, okay, you can drive your SUV if you plant 10 trees. You know, certainly, you know, there is that. But again, 10 trees get planted that might not have gotten planted because that person's going to drive their SUV.
But the other people are still polluting the earth. but can get away with it because you can plant 10 trees. It just doesn't work for me.
At some point, you're going to run out of places to plant trees.
410-319-8888.
On that.
Pastor
that
Britt,
note.
You're on the air. Oh, wait, no, you're not on the air yet. Let me get you on the air. Yeah, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay, Mark. Good to hear your voice again.
Good to be back.
I actually agree with your fellows on there that the guests, when they're talking about that we're dealing with Earth world changing situations, because we really are, and we're involving the rank and file people, the people out there that drive the buses, etc. And in prior ages, they were never involved. I'm on the radio, as you know, as a guest quite often, 2-3 times a week across the country, and when any of these things happen in this political arena, the Jeremiah Wright thing, or Obama says something, or this guy says something, when people call in, what I sense in their voice is actually fright. They talk quickly, they are enraged, but remember, fear and anger are the same emotion exactly. And I think what I'm hearing, the people that call into these stations, in many cases what you would call right-wing stations, is they're afraid. They are faced with these issues, and they're terrified, so they're avoiding them. And I think the press follows along.
I think that...
Yeah, I don't know who's afraid or not afraid. I mean, if you compare this campaign, let's say, to the 2000 campaign, which was the most ludicrous journalistic campaign of all time, in 2000, we had a framework in which people thought we were at peace and in a time of prosperity, and there were no real issues. What difference did it make? This was the journalistic framework. What difference does it make? Which one of these two guys gets elected? There's no difference, and you know, and we've gone past the end of history, and blah blah blah. That was a campaign 8 years ago. Took part in a journalistic atmosphere, which everyone thought there are no issues anymore. Who cares? Things are getting better. It doesn't matter. Now it's obvious, there's a string of issues, existential issues confronting this country. I don't see any difference in the way the campaign is being presented. And it's July. I mean, you know, and granted, many people aren't paying attention. Many people won't be paying attention in October. But again, it's that refusal to look at these issues that's predominant.
Well, I don't want to, let me be clear.
Thank
I
you,
mean,
Master
people
Britt.
Are discussing politics. I guess I was referring to the major focusing on the media outlets and sort of watching every day the way in which we were watching during the Maryland primary, or when we were watching, you know, through the last of the series of primaries that we had
yeah.
nationally. And you're, the climate change, I'm really excited. Actually, one of the things I'm doing is I'm on the Baltimore City Sustainability Commission. And so Baltimore City is actually looking at some of these issues around climate change and trying to, and part of it's about fear, but I think also it's, part of it is about trying to prepare for the future and try to take responsibility for what we're leaving future generations. So I think there is a concern in the public that what will there be for our children, or what will there be for us in our old age? I turned 46 this year, and so in thinking about, well, you know, I'm probably about halfway through, and I know a lot of my cohort, you know, haven't followed, you know, various generations that have had impacts on national politics and a social change, wondering what's our legacy? What are we going to do? And so I think that this political season is very critical in that for the first time, I know in my political life, I have a sense of hope about the future that was generated in part by Obama's campaign and having someone that we could be excited about. But I think it's also a sense of urgency that, hey, this is it, guys. We really need to take a stand and do something now.
See, that's interesting because I have exactly the opposite feeling. I'm older than the 46, but I have to say my feeling is now our intellectual, quote-unquote, elites are so broken. I've just really come to the feeling, and especially when you look at the climate change, where we've been told there's a sort of a window of opportunity. I mean, you got Jim Hansen says it's like 10 years, you know, leading climate scientists, sort of Gore-connected science, climate scientists. I don't believe we're going to do anything about any of this stuff. I just think we've reached a point where our elites are so bloated and so sated and so dysfunctional that I just don't see any indication in any area that American elites are capable of focusing on anything, of caring about anything. They go off to their ideas festivals and, you know, have their parties all night. But, you know, if you have a fatal allergy to ideas, go to the Aspen Ideas Festival. That's the safest place on earth for you to be if you have an allergy to ideas. I mean, I just think, so I have a very different feeling. I just feel like there's something that's gone so deeply wrong with the way we conduct business in this country that we just are incapable of focusing on any problem. We just don't do it.
Well, because we don't want to make the hard choices have to be made to make those decisions, I think.
But it isn't a matter of getting to decisions. We don't even get to the point where serious...
But before we kind of run out of time in this segment, I wanted to, Mary, you said something to us before we went on the air here that I want to kind of throw out to the public and let people chew on a bit, because I think it's important, and maybe you can talk about this for a few more minutes. You said that several friends of yours who are school teachers who, in the Baltimore City school system, who were, had incredible results in terms of test scores of their kids and working with as really good teachers, have gotten their notice and have been laid off.
Yeah. I mean, my understanding is, and I understand, first of all, let me just say that I really appreciate and respect and admire all of the work that Dr. Alonzo is doing. And I think, I'm impressed with the idea of starting a school in North Avenue that was on the front page. And instead of simply expelling our children that are challenged, bringing them actually home
right.
And, you know, being close to the people who they are working with. But at the same time, there is an issue in that faculty that have been in the school system 10 years, 3 years, have received their termination notices because they weren't certified. And again, I understand that we're out of compliance under the No Child Left Behind Act and that we need to make sure that we have levels of certification. But I do have a concern that how are we going to replace up to 600
students.
Teachers have been laid off. And in particular, what is the short-term impact going to be on test scores if you have teachers that are doing well and yet they don't have this certification? So it's just something that I learned about and I just was interested in if anybody knew anything about it and if there's a plan for replacing these teachers.
I don't know, but we're glad we're out there. We'll maybe take a look at this, and maybe the next week we can learn more about it and talk to the school system and get some teachers in here to find out just what happened to them and who they are and why this happened. I think that'd be important to do. And right now we'll go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Sheldon, you're on the air. Oh, no, you're not on the air yet because I have to push your button, and I'm pushing your button now. There you go.
Yes, I'm calling. I was a very strong supporter of Senator Obama in the primaries. I contributed to his campaign. I believe that he demonstrated more integrity and independence of judgment than most candidates for president in my lifetime. I don't see the current controversy over his statements on issues as being a question of moving to the right or being a flip-flopper. For me, the question is whether he will make decisions out of principle and not for purposes of political expediency. For that reason, his current position on FISA is extremely troubling. It's totally indefensible. The current bill is, if anything, worse than the previous one, which he voted against. And the justifications that he's given to his supporters for changing his position are really an insult to those supporters' intelligence. And that's what I think has resulted in a loss of enthusiasm for Senator Obama. If you go on his website, you'll see that this issue has generated the most email, the most blogging, and most of it is quite negative regarding the change of his position.
Let me let our panel very quickly tackle this before we run out completely out of time here and give a minute to kind of do this before we go to break. What do you think about that? I mean, these are positions that moved to the Senate, but seemed to be changing a major position he took in the campaign and when he was voting in the Senate.
Yeah, FISA is an issue I don't really know much about. I mean, he's going to
That music means we have to go to a break here, and I want to thank Mary Washington and Bob Summerby for being with us in the studio today. When we come back, we're going to take a journey back through history. 60 years ago right now, there was a historic tennis match at Druid Hill Park. Blacks and whites and Jews broke the color line, got arrested. It became a very powerful statement for this community. We're going to meet some of the people who were in that match. And so stay with us. We'll be right back. Mark Steiner, and welcome back. 60 years ago, on July the 11th, which I believe is Friday night, and there'll be a celebration, and we'll talk about that in a bit. On July 11th, 1948, a group of black and white and Jewish citizens of Baltimore City walked on to the clay courts, tennis courts in Druid Hill Park. This is a time when Baltimore and America was still segregated, deeply segregated. And a group of people who were associated with the Progressive Party, who were white and black, and black citizens who were part of a tennis club here in Baltimore, went into the white facility to begin a tennis match. They didn't do it on the sly. They told the police they were coming. They told the parks they were coming. They told everyone they were coming. And they were going to make a statement that segregation had to end, equality had to be the mark of the day, and went in and were arrested. And it was a very important moment in American history and in Baltimore history. And we forget that just 60 years ago today, the danger that people were in if they attempted to cross color lines in our community and what that meant. And so this Friday night, between 5 and 7 p.m., at the Conservatory in Druid Hill Park, there will be a celebration of that event that took place 60 years ago with some of the people who luckily are still with us from that day when they walked onto those courts. And there will be a theatrical reenactment of that moment that evening. And right now we don't have to have a theatrical reenactment. We have some of the people who were there. Joining us in studio is Mitzi Swam, who was 18 in 1948 and played on those courts on July 11th, 1948, was arrested for her participation and playing that tennis match. Nellie Briscoe Garner joins us by phone. She was a teenager at the time and was in attendance, and in her time was a local tennis star here in our community. We're also joined on the phone by Douglas Bishop, who was a lifeguard at what was known as the Colored Pool in Druid Hill Park. Both the pools and the tennis courts in Druid Hill Park at that time were segregated. So let me welcome Mitzi Swan, Nellie Briscoe Garner, and Douglas Bishop to the show. It's good to have all three of you with us.
Oh, thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Many of you may have personal recollections of that moment. Many of you may be the sons and daughters and grandchildren of people who were there at that moment. and have some familial memories you want to join us with as well, or just talk about the significance of that situation. Let's talk about what that moment was, and start with Mitzi Swann and then go to Nellie Briscoe Garner, because you, Mitzi, were at the forefront of that. You and Mary Coffey, who was a year older than you. She was a student at Morgan State University. You were then a sophomore at the University of Maryland, College Park.
That's right.
And tell us about that moment and how this took place and what happened.
I'll start with what happened that day.
Okay.
A man and I went to the tennis permit office to get a permit to play. We went 8 o'clock in the morning, and we had we did get a permit because we were both white. We had to wait until 2 o'clock until the matches actually started. Well, you can imagine the kind of anticipation that would take place. You knew in your heart you were going to be arrested because it was against park policy to have interracial games on the courts or any kind of interracial activities in the park. So we waited till 2 o'clock, and then when we went on the courts, we had the four men on one court, the two black and two white, and on another court were the women, the two black and two white. As soon as the men started to play, to pick up their rackets and get ready to play, the police were there. They were there ahead of time because they knew what was going to take place. And it was a very scary thing, as a matter of fact, because you saw all these police around, and you knew they were waiting to come after you. And also, there were the police vehicles. The Black Mariah was there.
The paddy wagon was called the Black Mariah back in the day. I remember that. Even in the 60s, it was called the Black Mariah.
That's right.
Right.
And we saw that there, so we knew what was going to happen. As soon as the men started to pick up the rackets and play, the police came right on the court and told them they were not allowed. And if they played, they were going to be arrested. Well, they picked up their rackets and started to play. And the police again said, "You're going to be arrested if you play." And they were arrested. Now, the men sat down on the courts, and they had to be carried off. That was quite a sight to see the policemen carrying these guys off the court. So after they did that, then they came over to where the women were, and they told us the same thing. If you play, you're going to be arrested. And we started to play, and of course we were arrested. But we didn't sit down. We walked off the courts. We just couldn't quite do that. Didn't want to see a cop carrying me off the court.
You were ladies. That wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, can you figure it? Being carried off. I mean, this is back in 1948. None of these other demonstrations have ever taken place where people were actually arrested doing things
right.
Like that. And so we were arrested, and everybody was put in the paddy wagons or police cars, but the three youngest women, it was me and two others, were taken down to the station in a police car. And we were in the judge's chambers, and the others were put in jail.
Nellie Briscoe Garner, tell me about that day for you and where you were that day.
Well, right outside of the conservatory, there's a hill. It's on the left side of the conservatory, if you're standing in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a hill that was just like a stadium. And I was on that hill waiting to play if I got a chance to play. Consequently, I wasn't arrested because my foot was not on a court. I was on
That's
the
nice
grass.
Way of putting it.
I was sitting on the grass. Waiting to play, so, and it was a devastating sight to see all of your friends that you've been knowing, playing with all your life and everything, to see them hauled off like that. It was devastating. That's all I, you know, can say about it. What could you do? And it's one thing that I want people to realize that this was not a law. It was Department of Rec's policy, not a law. It was their policy that they do this. And like Mitzi said, you needed a permit to play. So after this broke up and we were allowed to play on those courts, we used to stand over there early, 6 o'clock in the morning, waiting for them to open up so that we could get a permit. But no matter when you went, all permits were gone. You never got one.
And Doug Bishop, you weren't there that day, but you were a lifeguard at the what was called the Colored Pool at Jubilee Hill Park. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, number two.
Right.
That's right.
And what years were you there doing that?
1953 and 1954.
I want to kind of step back for a minute. If you could set the tone for a second. I'm just starting with Nellie and Doug. And what the tone was for you in Baltimore then is young black people... in this community, World War II had ended. Black soldiers had gone to war and come back and kind of started the core of young African Americans in that period demanding a seat at the table after the fighting that was done in that war. And many of those young men who came back were from Baltimore. And I was wondering if you could just talk about what the tenor of that time from your perspective. Nellie?
Well, we were so... what's the word I want to use? We were removed from segregation because we had been by ourselves for so long. And then you were thrown into this pot. I said, oh my goodness, you know, it was like a wake-up call, really a wake-up call for a lot of the black kids at that time that this is really what's going on. You must understand that. You live with your family, you stay in your area, you go to your schools and everything. Segregation at that time didn't bother me a bit because I wasn't concerned with it. I was concerned with learning. And then all of a sudden, bang, it hits you. And that's when you sit back and take notice of what is going on around you. It takes a little while for some of us to wake up. You know, and that's the tenure of the time when this occurred.
And I was thinking about that, Douglas Bishop, because we were in a time in the late 40s and early 50s in Baltimore in America where we were still kind of in the era of extreme violence against black people, where lynchings were not a distant memory, that for people to cross the color line and to stand up was a pretty powerful move and statement.
Yes, it was.
Go ahead, Doug. I'm sorry.
That was Nellie.
Elliot,
I just said yes, it was.
Oh, so that was you, Nellie. I'm sorry.
Okay.
So I was just curious about the kind of what the conversations were taking place at that point, and how did it take place that in that time in 1948 that blacks and whites got together to even cross the line to begin this conversation about going to the tennis courts? How did that start?
I think Mitzi can answer that
best. I was in the Young Progressives, which was the from the, you know, the Progressive Party, and that was a third party taking place at that time with Henry Wallace was running for president. And there was discrimination, and the interesting thing was in our membership we had a couple. The husband was Filipino and she was white. And they used to go to the courts, and they were not allowed to play because his skin was dark. And so we talked about that. And then we also had people in our group who were veterans, and we also had the college students. And we had people that had trouble with jobs because they were black. So we decided to make a statement that this was wrong, and we staged that demonstration. We planned it, and we wanted this thing to be in the forefront of people's consciousness so that they would know what was happening in this country or in Baltimore. And that's what took place. But one thing I want to add, when we were all arrested, it was instantaneous, and I don't know how it happened, but the whole group started to sing My Country, 'Tis of Thee, America. And even now, when I think about it, it sort of gets me a little bit choked up because it was such a stirring moment that this was no one planned it. It just happened. And that, to me, made a statement. It's, well, even now I get a little bit choked up when
That's
I talk
okay.
about it.
Yeah, it's true. That's true.
We're talking about what happened 60 years almost to the day, July 11th in 1948, when Baltimoreans, black and white and Jewish, crossed the color line and walked onto the whites-only courts at Juratoa Park, and became a huge part of that moment and of our history, defying segregation, saying segregation must end, the courts must be integrated, people were arrested. The trial went on for a very long time. There were people there. As I read this history, really came back to me, some of the names of the past that many people don't even know anymore. People like Duke Avnet, who was a labor lawyer in town, who was a dear friend actually of my mother's, and who defended people. Harold Buckman, who was a lawyer who crossed the line, and my friend Lou Pinckney's father, who was there on the courts. That day, Lou Pinckney just left us. He was a Vietnam vet, one of my closest friends in life. But his father was there on the court that day. And it was a very powerful moment when citizens in the city stood up and made a very, I mean, it was very frightening, a very frightening moment and a very powerful moment for people who kind of almost put their lives and limbs on the line in the heart of segregation here in Baltimore South. Join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, to join in this conversation with two who were there, Mitzi Swan, who was arrested that day, Nellie Briscoe Garner, who was a teenager on the Hill, supporting there, was prepared to be arrested herself, though was not that day, and she became a tennis star here. Doug Bishop is with us. He's a lifeguard at the Colored Pool at Juratoa Park in the 50s and remained there during the 60s. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. 88. And I wonder when you, and by the way, let me just say there's going to be a reenactment of this, this Friday night at 5 o'clock at the Conservatory in Druid Hill Park. We'd like you all to join us there, and it's going to be a very interesting evening. Many of the people who are on the show today will be there, and you can meet some of the folks who actually were there and made this historic moment part of our life. What do you think this says for the young people today who would be literally your grandchildren at this moment, who go to our public schools, our private schools, and have never heard of this moment? Let me start with Nellie Briscoe Garner and go to Mitzi Swan and also then Doug Bishop.
Well, we had a tennis camp at Druid Hill Park. My nephew started a tennis camp out there, David Owens, for quite a while, and every now and then, every year, maybe once a year, we would take all of the kids over to that side, to what was normally called the Negro side, where the tennis courts were. And we would sit down and talk to them and tell them about what happened over here at that time. Because by then, the clay courts were gone. They're not there any longer where their rest was. But we would talk to them every year, and some of them were very wide-eyed about it, and some of them could, as normal, could care less. right now, they can pick up a racket. If they got a racket, they can pick up a racket and go play on any public court, and it doesn't get through to them.
Right.
It really doesn't.
And the reason they can pick up those tickets right now, those rackets and play, is because of what you and Mitzi and others did. Mitzi?
A lot of people just never knew what took place at that time. People today don't, especially if you meet people from New York or other places, they never had that. They never had with the segregation that we had here in Baltimore, because we were sort of like a southern state.
We were a southern state.
And so they were all surprised that this took place, because their schools were integrated and their public facilities were integrated, and they could go to restaurants. And in Baltimore, they couldn't. Nellie would know better than I would of what would take place if someone of color would try to go in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So this to me was just, that is why we did it in the first place.
Doug Bishop, you want to jump in? We haven't heard from you in a bit. And your thoughts on the significance of this for young people who haven't heard about this.
Okay. Well, we had a splash party not too long ago on June the 21st at Druid Hill Park Pool.
Mm-hmm.
This pool was the number one pool, and we had a chance to talk to a lot of the lifeguards there and to a lot of people. and we were explaining to them the difference between that pool and the pool that we used to use, and we tried to tell the kids that they have a lot of opportunities now, they should take advantage of them and move forward in their lives, because the future looks bright. But we explained to about how the pool was and what it meant to us and this sort of thing. And we just tried to show the difference between the two pools and then what things were back then and what things were now. And we tried to realize that that there have been some improvements, and the kids just have to take advantage of things and move forward.
We're talking with Doug Bishop at this moment, who was a lifeguard at the Colored Pool at Jewel Hill Park. We're joined by Nellie Briscoe-Garner, who was a teenager in 1948, became a tennis star, and Mitzi Swan was 18 in 1948. We're talking about the July 11th, 1948, the 60th anniversary coming up of blacks, whites, and Jews across the line at the whites-only courts at Jewel Hill Park, and were arrested, began to change the nature of our city with their acts. Join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And let's go to the phones. And Denise in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Denise, good morning.
On my way to work, and I've gone to the dentist, and so I'm usually at work at this time, so I normally don't catch your show, but I happen to have 88.9 on my radio. I'm so glad that I did.
I'm glad you did, too.
Thank you. I'm 31 years old, native of Baltimore, born and raised. Both my parents are from Baltimore. I've never heard about this, and I'm just so thankful that I'm hearing about it today. And thank you to the ladies and gentlemen who, through your acts, just made a stand for all of us. And I'm just very glad that I caught this. This is very informative, and like I said, I've never known. My parents had never shared this with me, that both of them would have been like one or two at the time. But I've
makes
never
me feel old.
I'm sorry?
No, it just makes me feel so old.
No. Please don't think that, but it's just, you're saying that young people need to hear this, and I'm 31, so I'm not that young, but I've never heard of this, and it's really important to hear. I mean, we hear about everything that happened in the 60s for civil rights, but this happened 12 years before 1960, and that's actually great to hear, because I had not learned about this, so I had to go to work now. But
all right.
Thank you all for your contributions, and thank you for making this known. I'm going out of town on Friday, so unfortunately I can't attend the event. If I had known earlier, I would have tried to go. But thank you so much for sharing this information.
Thank you so much, Denise.
Have a wonderful day.
You too. And what we're talking about is this Friday night at 5:30 at the Conservatory on Druid Hill Park. There will be a reenactment of that event. And a celebration of that day with many people who were there. You go from 5 to 7 o'clock, 5:30 to 7:30, in Druid Hill Park at the Conservatory. You can join us for this wonderful event and to remember these heroes and the heroes from 1948 who are still with us, thank God. Let me read an email that goes to a point that actually Denise just raised. And our email address, by the way, is steinershow@gmail.com. Jessica writes in from Mount Vernon. Hi, Mark and guests. One of the most surprising things about this event is that it happened in the late 40s and not the 60s. What are the guests' thoughts on why a civil rights event like this, which seems to have all the hallmarks of a 60s event, could happen so early in Baltimore? Good question. What do you think, Mitzi?
I don't know. This third party that we were members of, the Progressive Party.
It would remind people, this was an election in 1948. Harry Truman, John Dewey were the main candidates. It was a Dixiecrat party for racists called, with Strom Thurmond was running for president, and another part of a third party called the Progressive
Party.
Yes,
and Henry Wallace was running for president at that time. And his platform was for civil rights, for the end of discrimination. And so that's why I was a part of it, because I believed in his platform. And that's why I participated, because that was part of my life.
You know, what made me think is, and we're almost out of time here, but I wanted to, when I realized this Progressive Party was so involved in this and made this coalition with the Baltimore Tennis Club, which was the black tennis club in the 1940s and 50s here in Baltimore, that it always takes an enlightened, courageous minority of people who were not in the mainstream. The progressives were not in the mainstream. Black folks clearly were not in the mainstream in 1948 in America to make a change, to stand up and go, this is wrong, it has to change. You know, it's never the folks who stayed in the middle of the establishment. It's always the folks at the edges who change what happens in America, whether it was the abolitionists in the 1840s and 50s, or whether it was Mitzi Swan and Nellie Briscoe Garner and all the others who stepped onto the courts that day and said, enough is enough and it has to end. And I want to say it's a huge honor to have you all on our show today. Mitzi Swan, Nellie Briscoe Garner, Doug Bishop, thank you for being a part of us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Our foremothers, thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, and meet us all over at the Conservatory 530 at Drew Little Park on Friday. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Jessica Phillips, Justin Levy, our engineer by Zachary Coleman. Our interns today are Judith Floyd and Christina Aronson. You can podcast this show and all other productions at www.centerforemergingmedia.org. And from Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.
We know that this is an important political year, and we hope you will exercise your right to vote in 2008.